Richard Seven. This is the. We'll finish off chapter five this time. It would allow us to go on to chapter six and seven, which are the more dynamical bits of the material. And they will. I had hoped to get them onto the Moodle today, but they'll appear this afternoon, I expect. The couple of things I want to mention, which I think I may have pointed out in the in a Moodle forum posting. One is in the Moodle there's a link to a previous year's, I think a couple of years ago, assignment one. So not this year's, previous year's. Good one to go to work through, because you can do everything in there you can do at present. But the thing that I wanted to draw your attention to was that although the notes at the bottom of that have fairly discursive extra commentary on the answer and so on, there's also a handwritten version. I wrote out by hand what would be a great answer, the sort of thing I would be happy at 2 o'clock in the morning to see popping up next on my screen. And that would go, that's going to get 16 out of 16. I'm not even going to bother reading it. So that's what you want. That's the sort of thing you want to be handing in. Now, the important points, as I mentioned in the Moodle posting, it's legible. It's okay. My handwriting isn't necessarily the most beautiful, but it's I can read it. If you want to make a typed version, that's good too. What it's not is a photograph of scribbles in your notebook. It's not a mess. It doesn't have to be beautiful. There's a couple of crossings out in here. A bit of Tippex wouldn't have done any harm, but it's not necessary. It is considered. It's a fair copy. This is not your first graspings at a solution. It's a thoughtful description of what the answer is. I added little comments to this, why such and such is a good thing to see in the answer. I encourage you to look through that. That's what the sort of thing that it is good to see in an assessment. If it's a mess, then there will be marks off. Because this is part. This is not just an assessment. This is part of the training for scientific communication, writing papers. If you ever end up in research, writing academic papers to be read by your colleagues, papers are there to communicate. They are there to show how an idea goes from the basic idea of what the point of this is, what the idea was, how it works out, what we discovered. You know, there's a structure to academic papers, and you're learning that in, for example, your lab reports. They are also an exercise in scientific communication. And although this is not a paper, it's the same rules apply. It's what am I communicating, who am I communicating it to, and how do I make it clear what I think. Remember that the point of any sort of assessment on an exam is to show that you are smart and you have a clue. One way or another, if you can communicate that, then marks will be found. If something's ambiguous in the question, then say, this seems ambiguous to me because A or B. And that's clear you have a clue. Okay? So if something were ambiguous, you pick one of the two and answer that question, and that's fine. No, they're not supposed to be ambiguous, but sometimes things get through that way. So study that. And remember, the point is communication. And I think I mentioned at the end of the Moodle posting was the mindset to be in writing an answer like this is, say one of your colleagues in the class said, I have no idea what's going on with this question. I don't even know which way, where to start. What would you write to them? So someone who'd been to the lectures, a bit confused, how would you make clear to them how you've understood it? That would help them. So that's the level you're aiming for. You're not really talking to me, you're talking to one of your colleagues. That's the amount of detail you need to include and exclude. You don't have to say what relativity is. Your colleagues know that. You don't have to, but it's not telegraphic. I could go on and on and on about that, because people seem very resistant to writing things down. I think that in schools, people are encouraged fill in the boxes. Would that be right? Yeah, bad habit. Don't do that. Teachers should be spanked for telling folk to do that. I mean, maybe it works for school-type assessments, but it doesn't work for higher education assessments. Right. Next thing I want to mention is the Padlet. Now there is a link to this on the Moodle. It's a great, this is a useful place, which I think I didn't emphasize the very first lecture because it didn't seem to work in Chrome on this machine, whatever. I couldn't persuade I was a human. Anyway, that thing is there. It's a very useful resource. It's a very good place to ask questions. I've seeded it. A couple of folk have already mailed me with questions, with good questions, excellent questions. And I've seeded it with a couple of those questions and the answers I gave. There's sections for each of the chapters. Just double click somewhere in the right sort of place, type in your question, and I don't get alerted when something appears there, but I do try and remember to look there from time to time. So it's not the fastest way of getting things, but it has the advantage that everyone else sees, oh, that's a good, I wish I'd asked that question. Or I'm glad someone else asked that question. So you can do a service to your colleagues by asking clever questions. Not by asking clever questions, by asking a question that is a problem for you, because it's probably a problem for someone else as well. I could blether on about this in more or less indefinitely. I will now close down that window. Just illustrate there are more chapters to come. And I will close down that and go to here and click window view. Okay, where we got to last time was talking about the Lorentz transformation and a little more beyond that. And it's taken us 5 chapters to get to this. Now, you will remember that you did a bit of special relativity in Physics 1 last year. See some vague, sort of slightly nervous noddings there. I think you did it in 2 lectures. You can get to this pretty promptly from a standing start, and you can see, and the twins paradox exists, blah, blah, blah. But I don't think you can actually understand much in just 2 lectures. So what we've done in this, what I've done in this route I've taken you to get to the Lorentz transformation, it's a fairly roundabout route, which goes via rethinking about the axioms, goes to rethinking about lengths and times, goes to thinking about Minkowski diagrams, was to thinking about space-time and geometry. And then this pops out in a fairly natural way, I hope. What we did last time, I hope, gave this a certain inevitability. So that's why we're only getting to this now. But the Lorentz transformations are, in a sense, the core tool of relativity. This expresses the whole the relationship between a moving and a stationary frame. And what we're going to talk about this time is 2 or 3 of the peculiar consequences of this. And what we're going on to next time is how do we, in the context of relativity, talk about kinematics, how do we describe motion? And after that, dynamics, how do we explain motion in a relativity context? Because at that point, we can talk about those things in a sensible way with this mathematical tool. So let us not dilly-dally. We talked about the velocity transformation, I think Minkowski, in 1908, so this was only 3 years after Einstein's 1905 paper. Very quickly this became, that's obviously the right way of doing things. I talked briefly about, I didn't work through this example because it's quite long. Maybe I should have, but I encourage you, I'll point you towards the relevant section in the notes to really think through that. It's a useful worked example to go through step by step and make things. So the next what we want to talk about is a couple of the paradoxes of special relativity. Now, the word paradox means a couple of different things in different contexts, slightly contradictory things. But what I am taking paradox to mean, the useful sense of that, is a scenario which appears to be wrong, appears to be self-contradictory, but is not. And by working out where the contradiction appears to be, we're working out being precise about where the contradiction appears to be and discovering why that isn't, in fact, a contradiction, you end up being propelled into thinking about the structure of what you're learning about. So paradoxes, in the term sense, in the precise sense I'm referring to them, are things which sound wrong but aren't. Okay, and the best known of them is called the twins paradox. You've probably heard about this from, you know, in popular accounts of relativity or on TV programs or whatever. It's simple, but it has caused more noisier and more fundamental disagreements about relativity over the last 100 years by people who, in some sense, ought to know better. So, first, a non-relativistic version. Odysseus, leaving Troy, battle-scarred, wants to go home, get a cup of tea, heads off toward Ithaca across the Mediterranean, right, in a straight line, because he has a clue. He gets from Troy to Ithaca. Problem solved. That's not what actually happens. He takes a detour and goes, you know, taking a dogleg route from Troy to Ithaca via Circe. Now, which takes longer? Which of these routes is the longer route? The dogleg. The dogleg version, yes. So very obviously. There's nothing complicated there. Going the indirect route is longer. If he's sailing through the Mediterranean, towing this taffrail log behind him, this little propeller, it'll turn more times if he goes the indirect route than if he goes the direct route. No problem. Right. Now, let's imagine a space age version of that, where this time Odysseus stays at home and Penelope heads off to a star which is 25 light years away at half the speed of light, turns around, comes back, ends up back at Earth. Okay? That's our dogleg route. Now, Penelope is travelling at half the speed of light, and that's a gamma of, I think, 1.15. So, you know, a bit more than one. So, Odysseus watching this, or people in Odysseus' frame watching this, will see Penelope's clocks run slow. Less time will pass. Going out and coming back. So, in both cases, Penelope's clocks are running slow, and so Penelope is younger than Odysseus when she gets, you know, say they're twins. That's what they call the twins paradox. Penelope is younger than Odysseus when she gets back home to Earth. And V equals half, gamma is 1.15, she is 87 years old when Odysseus has aged 100 years. Because it takes 100 years, going half through the light, 25 light years out, 25 light years back, the whole thing takes 50 years there, 50 years back, 100 years. So that 100 years is why that's 100 years. Okay? No problem. That's nice and straightforward. Well, now you understand about relativity and time dilation, that's not a problem. But then some bright spark says, oh, but from Penelope's point of view, it's Odysseus who's moving. He's moving at half the speed of light in Penelope's frame, which is true. So Odysseus' clock will be running slow on the way out, and the same is true on the way back. So Odysseus' clock will be running slow. So by the time Penelope gets back home, she'll be 100 years old, and it'll be some age, and it's Odysseus who'll be younger than her. And that's a problem, because while two people in different frames can measure the length of a clock. Of a rod, and they mutually measure each other's rod to be shorter, length contracted, as we discussed in chapter 3, I think it was, whenever it was. That's not a problem, partly because you're there talking about extended things. And in that same scenario, we discovered that the two observers on the trains could look at each other's watches and work out that time was being dilated, that the time was moving slower, you know, symmetrically. In the two things, that doesn't mean that isn't a problem. Here, well, we're looking at two people with two clocks arriving at the same time, and those two clocks that arrive at the same point at the same time, they can't both. One can't be behind and ahead of the other. That can't happen, because you're talking about two things that are happening at two time observations that are happening at the same place and the same time. Because when you're talking about the time dilation in the trains moving past each other scenario, there the observations being made are, if you go through it carefully, be observations of different clocks at at different times. So you're making a statement about the passage of time in the other frame, as opposed to making a statement about the passage of time on a particular clock. Okay. That's a point which is important, but which bears a second thought. So read through the notes on this. So what's happening here? This seems to be just wrong. There seems to be a paradox, I think, which can't be true here. And this has caused, as I say, this has caused people who were professionally engaged in thinking about relativity to say, oh, relativity must be wrong. Oh my God, what's happening here? That is a deep problem. It's not, because the thing that we haven't stressed is that Odysseus and Penelope are not vague about who's been out and who's turned back. The situation is not symmetric, because only one of them has turned around at the remote star. In order to go out and come back, Penelope's had to go to up to half the speed of light and then slow down and then turn around. So she is in no doubt that it's her who has slowed down and turned around. And that, in a way, breaks the resolves the paradox. The paradox comes because we think that the two observers are symmetric, and so the whole time dilation thing has to happen the same way for both of them. It doesn't, because only one of them actually turns around. There's no ambiguity there. And another way you can think of this, and the key point there is that there is no inertial frame that Penelope stays in throughout the entire adventure. Odysseus is standing still in his inertial frame and stays in that inertial frame the entire time. Penelope is in an inertial frame on the outward journey and in an inertial frame on the inward journey, but they're not the same inertial frame. And that's where, in a sense, the problem fails to appear. And you don't even have to worry about the slowing down and turning round, because what Penelope could do is, when she gets to the star, she notices that someone is heading inward, back toward Earth, at the same speed, conveniently. And she says, okay, here's my logbook. Could you take that back to Earth? Or, this is the time showing on my clock. You know, she sends a radio wave or something to say, this is the time on my clock. Can you reset your clock to this and keep track of how much time there is? So the fact that there are three inertial frames happening here is what breaks the symmetry. Another way we can see that is by looking at the relevant Minkowski diagrams. So, I'm not sure which one of these is the one that is. I think that's the one that appears on, what do we call it, Echo 360, rather than this one. So on that basis, that's the one that will be recorded in the... Oh, just parenthetically. The other thing I meant to mention, which I think I did mention in a blog posting, is that the sound recordings of these lectures are available in two places, one via Echo 360, and there is a link from the Moodle page to that collection, and also my own recordings, the other ones, are also available as a podcast linked there. I think the Echo 360 ones have video attached to them, of the slides or this. I think my ones have had a better audio quality, because I don't really know which microphone that I'm supposed to be using. So whichever one works for you is fine. They should have the same content. I would be interested in any problems with either of them. So I'd be interested in some feedback on which one of these works. Because if the Echo 360 one works fine, then I didn't bother making my own recordings. Anyway, so I believe that the pad is that visible? Yes, it is. Good. Okay. So the Minkowski diagram. There is Odysseus' frame. X and T. And Odysseus goes from the origin, where the two twins separate, to the endpoint. Just straight, his waterline is along there, nice and simple. a very simple water line that stays at x equals zero as time moves on. So that's the sequence of points that, that creates the water line. Penelope heads off in this sort of direction. So her, if we draw her, so that's the water line, Penelope the water line. And if we, if she's stationary in her frame, the prime frame, then she is moving along the T-prime axis of her frame. Nice and simple. And so that's what the Minkowski diagram of her frame on Odysseus's frame looks like. We get to let's call that event one, when she does the turnaround. Okay. And at this point, she enters a different frame. She changes frame into a frame which is not moving in that direction at half the speed of light, but moving in that direction at half the speed of light. How do we draw that on the Minkowski diagram? We draw her water line looks like this. In the new frame, so she's moving at a constant speed in the negative x direction. As time increases, she's moving in the negative x direction. So in that other frame, that's the t double primed frame, and there'll be a sort of x double primed axis there. But right now, one thing. So what I'm getting at here is that I have sort of resolved the paradox by saying that she changes frames and that they're not symmetric. What I'm doing now is trying to give you a bit of a clue into where this extra time went. Why is it that there's 13 years or whatever it is suddenly missing from Penelope or from only one of the two other participants? So at the point where she turns around, that time there is simultaneous in Penelope's frame with an event which happens at Odysseus at event two. Why have I drawn it at that angle? Because that's parallel with the X prime axis. The X prime axis is the collection of events which all happen at T prime equals zero. Okay? So if I were to draw the diagram x primed, t primed, all of the events which happen along the x prime axis happen at t prime equals zero. All the events which happen along a line parallel to the x prime axis happen at the same t prime. So there, the events which happen, event one and two, because they're parallel to the x prime axis, they happen at the same t prime, so they are simultaneous in Penelope's frame, but not simultaneous in Odysseus' frame. And then in the new frame that Penelope has jumped to, the x prime, x double prime axis comes along here, and there's an event three, which is simultaneous with event one in Penelope's new frame. So event one is simultaneous with event two in Penelope's outward bound frame, and simultaneous with event three in her inbound frame, and so that's sort of where some of the time's gone missing. If you're looking for where's the time gone missing, where the 13 years gone, it's sort of there. Another way of thinking about this is if every birthday Odysseus sent out a happy birthday message to his twin sister, then they would these by radio, then these birthday greetings would be sent out at regular intervals, at the speed of light, so at 45 degrees, and would, by the time Penelope is halfway there, she's only receiving the birthday greetings from the first half of Odysseus' 100 years. So she, from her point of view, they appear to be slow, they appear to be late. On the way back, however, and you have to sort of think this through, it's not completely obvious. Odysseus is still sending her bus through Greece at regular intervals, but on the way back, Penelope is seeing them at faster than once a year. So she sees the birthday greetings being slower than once a year on the way out, and sees the birthday greetings being faster than once a year on the way in. So she still sees 100 of them, but they don't add up to 100 of her years. I haven't shown that not adding up on the diagram, but this is the way you can think about how the different perceptions of the passage of time go in Odysseus' frame and Penelope's. If that last bit doesn't make a lot of sense, don't worry. I think I mentioned it in the notes. This is the point here is just that I'm showing that you could, that again, building up a rather messy, a rather complicated Minkowski diagram step by step. I want to suggest to you where the where the extra missing years have gone. I could keep talking about that, of course, more or less indefinitely, but. Are there things that, this requires going away and thinking about, but the things that are puzzling right off the top of your head? What things, you're all looking a little bit shell-shocked, or big sighs, or something. Are there things that seem obviously amiss? Work it through again in your head. Oh yeah, question there.
On the diagram, is when the messages are being sent, mm-hmm. like back and forth, are they meant to be at a specific angle relative to?
They're all at 45 degrees.
Okay.
But they're all radio signals.
Oh.
So they travel at the speed of light, which is one light meter per meter. So yes, they're all at 45 degrees. Yes, that's not. I think if I drew the diagram slightly differently, that would be clearer. Okay. Question there.
So the T double prime and X double prime.
Yeah.
That's the frame of the way back.
The way back, yeah.
And it's the point it starts at is like when they turn around.
That's right. Yes. So that's a good point. Yes. So if the frames, the frame S and frame S prime, are in standard configuration, frame S double prime is not in standard configuration with respect to others. Because why? What is it that makes it not in standard configuration?
Doesn't start from the origin.
Yes. So the origins of S and S prime coincide at the origin. The origin of S double prime, which is at event one, which doesn't coincide with anything. So you could use the Lorentz transformation to get from frame S to frame S prime, but you could not, without further algebra, use the Lorentz transformation to get naively from frame S primed to S double primed, because they're not in standard configuration. That's a very good point. Okay. And there's the diagram drawn somewhat more neatly. It's in the notes. The other point that's worth mentioning here is that the dog leg in the original Mediterranean version, Penelope, Odysseus in this version, it clearly takes a longer route because he goes a dogleg route, and as we all know, a straight line is the shortest distance between two points. We all know that, don't we? But this is a good point to mention that in the geometry of Minkowski space, a straight line is the longest distance between two points, it turns out. And there's an exercise in the one of the exercises in attached to this section allows you to work through that and perhaps reassure yourself that's particularly the case. So in the Minkowski space, with the right intuition, boom boom, with the right intuition, but at some point it becomes obvious that a dogleg route is going to be shorter because it's not the straight line route. I emphasise that when I talk about the exercises, I mean the exercises attached to these notes, which are in the lecture notes folder. The tutorial handbook has exercises attached to relativity. They are good exercises. I'm going through those, but they're not as tightly keyed particular sections as my exercises are. So just to avoid ambiguity there. Okay, moving on. The other famous... I won't draw that. I'll blow that up. The other famous paradox is the pole in the barn paradox, or the ladder in the barn paradox, or various other variants of that. And you have a barn, which is 10 metres in length. And you have a farmer with a pole, which is 20 metres in length. And a very agile young farmer who's able to run at a speed where gamma is 2. So the farmer is running through the farm at whatever that speed, at 0.86 of the speed of light, gamma is 2. And so the pole is length contracted from 20 metres to 10 metres. So gets into the barn, the farmer's wife slams the door shut, and so the pole's entirely inside the barn because it's length contracted. Very athletic and all that, but you're sort of familiar with that idea from other things about length contraction. But then you look at it from the point of view of the farmer running. In the farmer's frame, the farm is moving at 0.86 the speed of light in the direction. So the pole, so the barn now, is length contracted from 10 metres to 5 metres. So it's ridiculous to suggest that the pole is going to be able to get into the barn, because it's 20 metres long in the farmer's frame, and the barn's only 5 metres long in that frame. So what's happening? Does the pole get into the barn or not? So you see the problem. How do we draw that in a Minkowski diagram? Let's have the farmyard, and the world lines of the front and back of the barn are nice and simple, because the barn isn't moving in the barn's frame. Okay, the barn isn't moving in the barnyard. So the world lines are nice and simple. The front of the barn, so the pole's going to be going in this direction. Front of the barn is lined up along the T prime axis, but we assume that it's going to be at x equals 0. The back of the barn, another nice simple world line. Okay. Now let's have the world lines of the front and back of the pole running through that. Let's have the world line of the back of the pole, something like that. And that's the back of the pole. And we've chosen our origins so that the at time equals 0, the back of the pole is at the front of the barn. Okay. So this is back of the pole. This is the front of the barn, at the back of the barn. And where's the world line of the front of the pole in this case? Well, it's going to be at it's going to be moving at the same speed as the back of the pole, so it's going to be at the same angle. So it'll be a line somewhat like that. And I'm going to sort of, by thinking through the consequences of this, I know that we're going to be talking about this being length contracted, so I'm going to draw it at an angle somewhat like this. No, I'm not. Ignore that. The way this works out is somewhat like that. So that's the front of the pole. So this is going to be our T prime axis. So it means our X prime axis is at the same angle in the other direction. And this is a Minkowski diagram drawn for the right speed. How do I know that? Because in this diagram, the pole fits exactly into the barn. So the angles aren't right for that speed and that gamma, but the relationship is right. So this shows the case where the pole is length contracted to just the right length of the barn. What does it mean to say the pole is length contracted to the right size of the barn? What it means is when we measure the length of the pole, it comes out to be the same as the length of the barn. What does when we measure the length of the pole mean? It means having two observations of the front and the back of the pole at the same time in the farmyard frame. In other words, at the same time t equals zero in the farmyard frame, there's an observation of the back of the pole being at the front of the barn, and at the same time, an observation of the front of the pole being at the back of the barn. And they are simultaneous in that frame. Therefore, that is the length of the pole in that frame. So when we talk about length contraction, what we mean is when you do that sort of observation, when you measure the length of the moving object in by that means, you get that distance, the separation between those two water lines being the same as the length of the pole. But notice that in the farmer's frame, whose farmer is stationary moving along the T prime axis. So for the farmer, I'm covered in putty chalk. For the farmer, lines parallel to the X prime axis are at the same T prime coordinate. So for the farmer, the event there of the front of the pole hitting the back of the barn happened at a negative T prime. So the back of the pole hitting, reaching the front of the barn happened at time T prime equals zero, happened at the origin, the way we set this up. But that event there happened at negative T prime. So it's already happened by the time this the back of the pole reached the front of the barn. So for the so those two events, that we the separation between which was our length of the pole in the farm in the farmyard frame, had nothing to do with each other from the point of view of the farmer, because this event happened before. So from the point of view of the farmer, very reasonably, from their point of view, the back of the pole, the front of the pole rather, was beyond the back of the barn at the time when the back of the pole was. So that event there is simultaneous in the farmer's frame with that event there, and that event there is happening beyond the back of the pole of the barn. So that makes sense from the farmer's point of view, because at the point where the back of the pole hits the front of the reaches the front of the barn, the front of the pole is well beyond the back of the barn, as it should be, of course, because it's longer than the barn. So the paradox disappears when you think carefully about what counts as simultaneous. And when you are talking about the length of something, you are implicitly talking about simultaneous events, because that's what we mean when we talk about the length of something. And when we talk about simultaneous events, then that's a frame-dependent thing. So if ever you are looking at a description of relative doesn't make sense because, online or whatever, what you look for to see why someone has confused themselves is where have they implicitly thought thought about simultaneity when it doesn't actually apply. It's simultaneity that is where it all breaks down in the base here. And we can draw that. Okay, we're back to here. That's that sort of thing I just drew, and that's the same scenario drawn in the farmer's frame, where X and T frame. So there, the event of the, it's very clear that the event of the front of the pole hitting the back of the barn happens at T prime negative. It's already happened by the time the back of the pole hits the front of the barn. Another way you can think about this is that if you were to try, if say this barn didn't have a, was built against a mountain or something, so it has a solid back wall. So the whole thing is just 10 meters, then rock. Then what would happen then? The pole can go beyond the end of the barn. In that case, the front of the pole would hit the back of the barn and would stop. Say it's an immovable mountain or something. But the back of the pole doesn't know that's happened yet, because the information that the front of the pole has stopped has to get to the back of the pole by a shockwave, which can't travel faster than the speed of light. as you work this all out, the information, even if the shockwave were to travel through all the atoms in the pole at the speed of light, it couldn't get to the back of the pole before the back of the pole got into the barn. So that's two different explanations of why this all makes sense. And that's also an important point, because in the two different frames, the two sets of observers have different physical explanations of what's going on, in terms of what the sequence of events is, what the physical things that are happening are. But they have to come to the same overall conclusions in terms of things that, of what things happen at the same place at the same time. With that introduction from me, it's probably a good idea, as I say, to go through that step by step in the notes, just let it resettle. We've plowed the ground. But again, are there puzzles that are immediate there? Any other clever, insightful, thoughtful, or just frankly baffled questions? All are good. Okay. There is a lot to take in there. The last thing I'm going to mention, and I'm not going to go through it in much detail, is Bell's spaceship paradox. John Bell was, he worked at CERN for most of his working life. He was very thoughtful about quantum mechanics and other things, a variety of things. Let's not talk about John Bell. And this, he raised this puddle in the CERN canteen one time. And said, "Oh, what would happen?" And there was a big argument, and the majority of the vote got put out with the wrong answer. So this confused them. They're only particle physicists, but two spaceships, two launch pads a kilometre apart. The spaceships take off and head off along the x-axis with the same navigation program. So they accelerate in the same way. The engines are designed to produce the right amount of thrust, and they accelerate in the same way. So they follow the same trajectory, just displaced a kilometre downrange. So they speed up. After a roughly short time, after quite a short time, it doesn't take a lot of time going at, say, accelerating at about g, to get up to a fraction of the speed of light. It's a remarkably short time it takes. We can work it out. But so they're moving at a relativistic speed at some point. So that's fine. Before they take off, we attach a bit of string to the two of them, a 1 kilometer long piece of string. And they take off, and they move along at relativistic speed. So after a point, this string is moving at a relativistic speed. So it length contracts. So it can no longer stretch between the two rockets. So it snaps. Fairly obviously. But in the rocket's frame, they are stationary. And the length of string is a kilometer long, and they're a kilometer apart. So there's no problem. So the string wouldn't. But there's another case where you've got to have the same answer in both frames. Either the string snaps and is destroyed, and there's bits of fragments of string flying around, or it doesn't snap. So which is it? And as I say, this caused an argument in the CERN canteen, and some people got the wrong conclusion. And the place where I went wrong in telling you that story, the place where you should have gone, aha, you've jumped a step there. The place where I smuggled in something was when I said, in the rocket's frame. Because in saying, in the rocket's frame, they're still a kilometre apart, assumes that there is a rocket's frame. But is there? This is a Minkowski diagram of the two trajectories of the two rockets, R1 and R2. And P1 is the sort of 1 year anniversary party of the people on the rocket. They're 1 year out from Earth, and they have a celebration. And the, but in their frame, at that point, they are moving in, well, in that direction, with tangent to the world line. So in their frame, and that frame also is in the standard configuration with respect to S. That's their t-prime axis, and that's their x-prime axis. But look at what that's telling us. It's telling us that the event which is simultaneous in their frame with the one-year party, P1, is not P2, but P3. In other words, it's an event which happens later on, after the one-year party in the other rocket's frame, at which point the rocket will have, you know, moved further. So P1 and P2, those two events, are simultaneous in the launch pad's frame. And so because of these trajectories are the same, they will be a kilometer apart. But the events P1 and P3 are further apart than that, more than a kilometer apart. So the string, and the string, if it's to be simultaneously at this one-year party and at P3, is having to stretch more than a kilometer, so it breaks. And I give a couple of other things, explanations of how you can think about this in the notes. But the point is, there isn't a frame where P1 and P2, which are simultaneous in the Earth's frame, where they are simultaneous in the rocket's frame. So there isn't a frame which is the rocket's frame. There are, there's all the way along that world line, there's a sequence of frames, which, because the rockets are accelerating, are not all in standard configuration with respect to each other. And so there's an infinite number of frames there you're talking about. And so there isn't one where the rocket, which is the rocket frame, where the two events are still 1 kilometer apart. That also needs going through again, settling down in your head. And I think that's one of the cases where the utility of the Minkowski diagram in getting things straight in your head on paper is clearest. Because this is a really perplexing thing. And the Minkowski diagram lets you draw it down. That's the end of chapter 5. We'll go on to chapter 6, kinematics, next time, which I think is tomorrow. I will get the notes up this afternoon, and I will see you then. Okay. Bye for now.